Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our post-session recap. Scott Rothschild and I are going to kind of try to recap some of the major things that happened this session, and particularly toward the end. We are finished. Last Friday was the final day, the sine die adjournment, which means that the legislature will not be back unless there's a special session. We'll see how that unfolds, but we have at least a few weeks off. Rob Gilligan, of course, is joining us and acting as our engineer and help us remember things. And Dr. John Heim, Executive Director, is with us off camera, but assures us he may have some comments. And we want to spend a very special birthday greeting today to Dr. Heim. If you were in the office, you'd be celebrating our fiesta that we're using to, I guess that's the reason we're having it, is that Siete de Mayo is what we're experiencing today. So happy birthday, Dr. Heim. Well, everyone, I think what we might just begin with is some breaking news from the Capitol. Scott?
Well, the governor has signed into law Senate Bill 61, which was the, I guess it's been called the fix to Senate Bill 423, the school finance bill. And this was the bill during the wrap-up that we that was meant to fix a problem with Senate Bill 423, which had somehow,
I'm waiting for your quick explanation of it.
Somehow, $80 million that was appropriated couldn't be spent.
That's probably the
And
easiest way to put
that's
it.
always a problem when you have money and you can't spend it.
Correct. So that's been taken care of. Probably the final thing that we'll be waiting for gubernatorial action on will be the budget bill. Of course, there were other bills that passed, but in terms of wrapping up things for school finance, what that clearly means, though, is that we kind of have a full package available for the Supreme Court to review, as expect they will. In your outline we sent today, and I think also in your news briefs, you also should have access to a statement the KASB is putting out today, really in response to the last two sessions. And one of the things we tried to do, I'm not going to read it directly, you can see it, but we really just thought it was important to commend the legislature for the work over the last 2 years. I mean, obviously, the final grade in some ways will come for the Kansas Supreme Court. We're not really making a prediction there, but we think it is important to realize the work that has been done. Really going back last year when the legislature, by mustering a veto override, restored a more balanced and more adequate tax system, which has made it possible to begin to really reverse some of the trends we've seen in K-12 funding, and not just K-12 funding, but really across the budget. Some of the points that we're really stressing is that, one, despite concerns about the economic impact of a tax increase, we've actually seen increased expectations of economic growth by Kansas and actual revenues coming in much higher than expected. So in that sense, it does not appear that the tax increase has been harmful to the economy. And maybe certainly part of that is because those dollars have been invested right back into the state economy by supporting K-12 education and other programs. That's likely to continue. One of the things that it's also important, we think, is to point out that really for the last really going back to 2009, K-12 funding per pupil has fallen behind inflation. It's fallen behind other states. We're becoming less competitive for salaries. And we, of course, believe that an impact of this has been an actual decline in our state assessment results. We've seen some falling in the last few years in our ACT scores. We've seen a leveling off of progress in graduation. We believe there is a direct funding between these consequences or a connection between funding and these academic outcomes, as we're going to talk about. There's other evidence to support that that we've seen during the legislative session. But we would also commend the legislature. I think this is important to saying they did kind of prove that you can restore funding for education and begin to make restoration to other areas of the budget where we know there have been a lot of concerns. We don't know whether this is going to be enough for the court, and I think we know that this isn't the end of the story, but it's important to note that over the last 2 years, in other words, the funding provided for the current school year compared to last year, and then what has been approved for next year, has been about a $400 million increase in state funding, and the commitment the legislature has made in this bill is for about another $400 million over the next 4 years. So it certainly is the most substantial increase in funding we've seen in about a decade. It's also important to remember that there's going to be 4 or 5 years of inflation going on as well. So those are some of the things the court will have to look at. I think it's also important for our members to know and help share with their legislators and the public. This money did not come without strings. This is happening at a time when we are implementing a new accreditation system, a new accountability system, new measures. And certainly, I think school leaders and KASB, working with the state board and the commissioner, are really committed also to a new level of results and helping students be successful. So those are all really important things we need to keep in mind. And I think the last thing is, it is important to thank those elected officials, policymakers, advocates who've worked so hard to make this happen. This didn't come easy. There were some tough votes that were made. And as we move into the kind of the public's grading opportunity is going to be in the election that'll happen throughout this year. So it's really important for people to understand and thank those who have made been a part of a, at a minimum turning around some of the directions school funding. Any other thoughts, Scott?
Well, I think you hit all the major points, and I think we should probably thank. You know, this is a kind of an amazing political turnaround that we've seen the past 2 years. If you think of the 2 years prior to these 2 years, I mean, we were in block grants, we were looking at allotments, and a lot of areas of state government were really suffering cuts, higher education, a lot of problems in social services. So the veto override last session, which established this new tax regimen, has really turned around our state and to the benefit of a lot of investments that people depend upon, public education, social services, higher education. And again, we're entering a political season, and I think those things need to be pointed out.
They're all going to be debated, and I think it's really critical that school leaders, you know, be a part of that debate, and certainly we'll do our best to help provide information to be a part of that. In your outline and also sent out today in the news briefs is a kind of a summary of the session. Leah Fleiter put that together over the weekend. I think she did a great job. Again, we're not going to go into every detail of it, but I think it's a really good summary if you want to share with your board and others, just kind of the highlights of what happened, really going all the way back to last fall when the Supreme Court basically said, you didn't get there last year. You didn't satisfy their concerns, and so there's no question that that issue of how the legislature would respond to Gannon dominated the session from before the session through this. One of the things that before we get into the bills that we might point out that I think was a very big deal was the legislature before the session leaders commissioned a new cost study, and so right about halfway through that landed. And you want to kind of recap a little bit what we learned from Dr. Taylor's study.
I think it's, I mean, the background of commissioning another cost study, advocates of public schools were saying, well, look, we've done the cost studies, and repeatedly they say you need more funding. So why are we doing another cost study? Well, the leadership of the legislature said, let's do one more. They picked a professor out of Texas A&M, and I think a lot of people were thinking, this cost study is going to come in and kind of lowball what is needed, because Dr. Taylor has done previous studies that did work in the for the state of Texas and things like that. So anyway, when she came in with her study and it said we needed between $450 million and $2 billion to reach the kinds of performance levels that we wanted, I think it shocked everyone, Democrats and moderate Republicans were, I think, pleased that, you know, finally there was a study that said, hey, this is going to cost some money.
I don't know if they were pleased at how much they were necessarily saying.
Yeah, I think that kind of caught everyone a little bit
off guard.
Yeah,
it did, and I think it has to be stressed, and this may, again, without going into Dr. Taylor's past work, is that part of her argument about the Texas study was saying, well, I was asked to identify what it would cost to reach benchmarks that were largely being met, right or wrong, and what she and the others involved, and there were other researchers involved in this, as many of you know, came back and said, well, you didn't tell us the goals. The legislature didn't set the goals. So they looked at the goals of the state board through our federal plan, other evidence that they said is what outcomes should be. And as we've been repeatedly saying, the outcomes they set would be beyond what any state has achieved.
Right.
And then said, you know, if you want to get to that level, you're going to have to spend a lot, because in me, the bedrock thing that they came back to is there is a link between level of funding and results. You can't expect significantly higher results if you're not willing to put in the resources. And that comports with other research that says, despite the claim sometimes that we're, quote, throwing money, I think what this study established is, well, if you're throwing money at more positions and more counselors and lower class sizes and providing additional support to help kids, you can call that throwing money, but what it really is doing is bringing more resources to bear. I don't know if Dr. Heim wants to weigh in from his economic background, but that's kind of what economics is saying, you know, if you're going to put more goods and services to bear on a problem, there's probably going to be a cost to do that. I think that's what they found.
Well, did you want to say something, Dr. Hyde?
Yeah, I'm not mic'd up, but I think we look at this huge number, and everybody says, oh, my God, it's a huge number. But it's also important to note that she said that that was achievable over time.
Correct.
And when you look at it in terms of a percentage, it's really not that giant of a number. If you look at it over 8 years as a percentage of what we're spending now.
I think that's absolutely correct. And that was, and again, some of you have seen, we've been repeatedly in these presentations talked about our takeaway. One of the takeaways is, yes, it can be phased in. That's appropriate. But the understanding has to be there are going to be effects of inflation which tend to erode that, and you can't make a commitment to do it and then quickly drop the commitment. And I think many people believe that we would not be in this position with the Supreme Court if we had simply kept the Gannon-level funding up to date. You know, if we'd have simply kept up with inflation and changes in student demographics over that time, it's unlikely we would be in the position that we are now. So good point on all of that. So again, the Taylor study will, I'm sure, continue to be debated, but it was a major part, I think the turning point in my view of that study in the session, it really took the idea that we can do nothing,
right,
you know, off the table, that somehow we were going to get evidence to say, no, what you did last year was enough and you should be fine.
Right.
People were no longer talking about that. And so then it became a question, honestly, of how much can we do without raising taxes? And let's be blunt there. I think all parties, all sides of the spectrum basically said, after the tax increase last year, we're not going to go back to the voters with that. And it then became a question of virtually everyone agreeing we needed to put in more to achieve those higher outcomes we want. We have to find a way to do it basically within, at least in the short term, existing revenues. And by the way, we can't forget about the rest of the state budget. And so the legislature did pass Senate Bill 423 based on that calculus. They then found out a couple of weeks later that state revenues looked dramatically better than everyone was expecting. And I think that helped people both feel better about the bill that they passed, and it gave them the opportunity to address some other parts of the budget, which they did.
Well, and one more thing about Dr. Taylor's study is, and I think it's the major footnote or asterisk in the study, is that she said school districts in Kansas are very efficient.
Absolutely.
Extremely efficient. And it was totally unsolicited remarks that she made, and it is in her study too. So I think that also kind of put to rest a lot of criticism from some quarters that we're not operating efficiently. So
I think that is a good point. And one of the things I believe that we have also linked to in other places, certainly in my blog, the Tallman Education Report, we talked about how really this $2 billion that seems so unthinkable would basically put you in the ballpark of what the most successful states in terms of achievement are spending.
Sure.
Kansas lags far behind them. And in fact, if we were spending that same amount of money, by her projections, we'd actually be getting higher achievement results, which I think you can bring back to the efficiency. So that's a good point. Well, the main way that the legislature responded, as we've said, was in Senate Bill 423. And in the report that we have, they kind of put some of the highlights to there. It is important to say that one of the things the legislature put an emphasis on was getting special education funding to a higher level. Mm-hmm. That's one issue. A second thing was adding some money to provide every student the opportunity to take the ACT test for free or the ACT Work Keys program for free. So that, again, is part of that package of accountability and that package of working on getting kids better prepared for success after high school. I think that was an important down payment. And then another thing which I think really reflects part of the Kansans Can value that also looks at social emotional indicators and was a way of trying to kind of blend support for education with other needs of the budget was the basically $10 million initiative for mental health that at least initially will be limited to several schools and several districts, mm-hmm. But it's trying to create a stronger partnership between schools and community mental health providers that hopefully can expand in the future as we see how that goes. So that's an important part of this, and there were some other elements. You've also indicated at the very beginning that almost as soon as that passed, it would become clear mm-hmm. that there was an issue in drafting that would mean that about $80 million, and there's been some debate even on that amount, would be unlikely to happen. The legislature ultimately passed last week Senate Bill 61. We keep calling it the fix, kind of in quotation marks, mm-hmm. because it became somewhat controversial. It did not just change the language. There were actually some changes made in what the way it went about. It did mm-hmm. not pull in local option budget dollars to fund a higher base, right. But it does require every district to have a minimum local option budget. That will continue. That is a change in policy, mm-hmm. but it's not something that is likely to affect any district now because everyone has a higher than 15% local option budget. So that became something of somewhat controversy, but it did become a part of it. Another thing it does that was noticed in debate on the floor, although this was actually originally part of Senate Bill 423 as well, is to require districts spend kind of a proportional amount of their LOB or mm-hmm. LOB in proportion to their at-risk and bilingual weighting mm-hmm. must now be spent, transferred into mm-hmm. those funds to spend on those purposes. It's frankly somewhat unclear as to how big a deal that will be. It may end up being more than a bookkeeping issue, or little more than a bookkeeping mm-hmm. issue. But particularly Senator Hensley, the Democratic leader in the Senate, raised a constitutional protest about right. that and suggested that might be a problem for the court. So again, part of the debate all along is whether that in some ways helps with the argument mm-hmm. by trying to claim more money as either part of the base or, in this case, more LOB dollars targeted to the students the court identified as not doing as well. At-risk students, bilingual students tend to lag behind. So that's something else the court will be having to consider 2 weeks from tomorrow when oral arguments will be held. So that was taken care of. Then I guess the next thing that happened as the final part of last week was the budget. And again, that there was not very much that directly impacts the main school finance formula in the end, as we've noted, Senate Bill 109. But there were a couple of things that are worth noting. A lot of money was put back into the CAPER system mm-hmm. to make up for some of the dollars that have not been paid in recent years. Now, my friends, one of the things you're going to understand when we start doing our analysis of how much of an increase did K-12 have, or mm-hmm. you know, how much of the budget is going to K-12 education, you know, that's been an ongoing debate. Do you count CAPERs or do you not count CAPERs? And people have tended to say, well, you know, what argument do we want to make? Well, this money is going to show up as part of state aid because it goes through the Department of Education budget. It goes to schools. It's not part of the formula. So a significant amount of additional funding, about $200 million more dollars, mm-hmm. are going to be showing as part of K-12 budgets, of USD budgets, but it's pass-through money. On the other hand, I think for those people who worry about the stability of the CAPR system, again, Dr. Heim is with us today, we'll be grateful in knowing that the legislature, once again, is part of this kind of climbing out of the hole and is putting considerable money there. The legislature also added some targeted dollars in early childhood. They agreed to the House bill that we talked about for much of the session for school safety, the $5 million matching dollars for school safety initiatives. It also includes a directive of the state board to develop some state standards. So there's a lot we'll be following over this interim in that area. Another thing that really came out of nowhere at the end that may draw some interest is providing about $500,000 for Teach for America to develop some teachers under that program. Some people love that program. Some people really have problems with that program. And I suspect we may see some of that, but the money is in to do there. $300,000 for a juvenile transition crisis program in the Beloit area. And then finally, an initiative that went back to Governor Brownback, about $300,000 that will be used to draw down some federal money for broadband infrastructure. So, Scott, any comments on those?
Well, just again, I mean, looking at these numbers and thinking back to where we were 2 years ago, these repayments for CAPRs, the mental health initiatives in the school finance bill, and a lot of these other things would just been have just been dreams without repeal of those tax cuts.
So, yes, there's absolutely no question that we're in a better financial position going forward. Might just note a couple of other bills that were passed, and in the end, there wasn't a lot of other legislation. Senate Bill 428 deals with child care licenses. This was basically just done so that if you have, like, drop-in programs, after-school programs, you don't have to worry. The program doesn't have to worry about child care licensing. House Bill 2498, probably rather peripheral, but could affect you because it basically says local school districts and other units of local government cannot restrict the wearing of tribal regalia. So, for example, at a graduation ceremony. House Bill 2444 deals with CAPR's investments in the Sudan. Again, not a big issue. It's kind of remarkable after all the years of CAPR's issues and every, you know, working after retirement, you know, finally a year where the biggest CAPR's issue has to do with investments with business, doing business in the Sudan. And now an issue that a bill that is likely to have potentially a bigger impact for schools, 2602, creates a task force on dyslexia issues. So I think we can expect that this is going to result in some possible changes in law or regulation. But at least this created a task force where educators, parents, providers, and others will all be able to kind of sit down and talk about this rather than just trying to have to out-lobby each other, which is what tends to happen if you have a bill. And then another task force, House Bill 2701, creates a state task force on broadband expansion. And so perhaps linking back, withdrawing down those federal dollars, this may be a way to try to expand broadband access where we know in some rural areas it's a major issue, if not for the school itself, for students. So these are things as long as I've been a lobbyist, people say, well, what do you do the rest of the year? You know, it's just a part-time job, isn't it? Well, actually, as soon as the legislature is over, there almost invariably are interim studies and task force and results, so we will definitely be following those. Scott, one thing that didn't happen at the end, though, when we're talking about the budget and some things, was a tax cut. You were following that closely. What was happening and what ultimately didn't happen as the session wound down on Friday?
Well, a lot of this was prompted by the changes in the federal tax law. And there was a provision in the legislature to decouple the state income tax from the federal code so that taxpayers who could no longer itemize on the federal form could still itemize on the state form. So this got back and forth. And then there were a lot of things put in the bill that dealt with repatriating money from corporations that had kind of sheltered their money outside the United States. This is
my favorite acronym, GILTI.
Yeah, GILTI. GILTI. What did that stand for?
GILTI, now Rob may have to help me out. The G is Global Intangible Low Tax Income. And it basically has to do with, again, all these ways of if you had money in offshore or in Ireland or something, part of the federal tax code was to let you bring that back. But now Kansas has to figure out how it's going to tax that or not tax that.
So I think the proposal was not to tax it. And so this passed in the Senate, and then it came over to the House, and there were just so many questions about it. I mean, they really didn't have a fix on how much this was going to take from the Treasury. And I think that was the biggest problem with the bill. And I think a lot of legislators are just gun-shy of tax cuts because the 2012 tax cuts... you know, pretty much brought the state near to bankruptcy. And so, well, that's probably hyperbole, but it produced so many problems that I think...
Ironically, though, during this debate, Kansas received, like, the first upgrading in its credit rating in 4 years or something like that. And so that probably played into it as well.
Yeah.
Again, just being cautious. Alternatively, of course, is that, you know, there is the fear that some legislators, again, may have a problem when they go to file their taxes. And the big issue is because of changes at the federal level, many people will not be able to itemize because the federal standard deduction is going up. Mm-hmm. In Kansas, though, if you can't itemize at the federal level, you can't at the state. Now, of course, this potentially, we are talking about tax year 18, and so next year's legislature potentially could still make some of these changes, I suppose, retroactively or something like that. Don't know whether they'll do that, but so this was really the drama of the very last day.
And there was also, I think, a lot of people just wanting to figure out how our budget was going to settle down over the next couple of years before they start diving into the tax problem or tax policy again. The Senate passed this bill, and then they left. And so it kind of put the pressure on the House to either accept it or not. And in the final tally, I believe they came up 4 votes short of passing this bill.
With more than 4 people missing, so it's kind of interesting.
There were 7 people missing,
yeah.
And I think within those 7 people, there may have been 4 votes for it. So, you can never tell, but just looking at the names.
And this is one of those things where, of course, as some people were pointing out, the Senate bill that kind of created all of this was not passed till the waning hours of the regular session at the last moment, and this is always that issue of kind of waiting till the last minute. The gamble is that the pressure will cause something to happen, but if you wait too long, the opportunity is lost, and that appeared to be what happened. So we'll be sharing with you votes on these. Again, this was not something the KASB had sort of an official record on, but we certainly were concerned about the unknown cost to it. And obviously, it certainly presents a more stable budget situation, the fact that ultimately this did not happen.
And I think a lot of education advocates, like you say, were concerned because if this tax bill sank the budget in a few years, that would affect K through 12 funding.
And that, again, I think it is the uncertainty because to some extent the intention was to say, well, we're just wanting to not take the extra, the windfall. But what we've learned is the ability to write a law that really reflects that, particularly with some of these other issues. Well, the last thing we may want to mention before we talk just a little bit about a blog and something we posted last week on comparing Kansas to Florida is what's next. And Scott, what will we be doing 2 weeks from tomorrow?
Well, what day is that? Is that
that's Tuesday, May 22nd.
Oral arguments before the Kansas Supreme Court. I believe they start at 9 o'clock
that's
in
correct.
The morning. Each side gets an hour, which means each side's going to get about an hour and 45 minutes. And then the court is going to make a decision before June 30th, I believe. So it's a big day, May 22nd, and we'll be covering
all over
gavel
that.
Gavel to gavel.
So certainly look for a post a post-argument update. We'll have that for you. And if there's things happening along the way, we'll share those as well. One of the things that actually the Supreme Court did agree to do was modify the briefing schedule because of the error.
Right.
But the parties are busy getting their briefs in so that the court can have them before the arguments.
By noon today, actually.
So we'll see
what they're arguing by this afternoon.
That's right. So, well, Scott, any other thing, or Rob or John, anything anything else about the session that we ought to note at this time?
Well, I think seeing the bipartisanship on the budget was interesting and a far cry from what's been going on the past few years. To me, that was a big issue.
I think that's true, and I think it's probably also important to say that the original vote on the school finance bill was razor thin,
right.
but it's not exactly partisan. What you tended to have was a split between people who didn't think it went far enough and people that went too far, and a bare majority saying, okay, we think this is where we can be. The so-called fix bill passed much more comfortably, and I think that was a recognition that there is a pretty good working majority of people that say, you know, we want to solve this, we want to do something, and so let's get there, and then, of course, wait for the court. The other thing that didn't happen, of course, that could be back if there's a special session, is the constitutional amendment issue.
Right.
And I think in the end there was just a feeling that there were clearly not the votes, not the two-thirds necessary. But I think if there is a special session, if the court, then we are going to be back talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the last thing I want to spend just a moment on, although there will be time for you to send questions to me, Rob, Scott, or Dr. Heim in whatever way you're able to get through, we'll be watching for those, is just for a moment to draw your attention. I think you have a link to a blog that I posted, but certainly did that. There's a lovely picture of my blog. But what it's talking about is about a month ago when the National Assessment of Education Progress scores were released, there was a lot of attention paid to the state to the fact that the state that really showed the biggest gain, mm-hmm, was the state of Florida. And since then, there's been some commentary from other organizations that have really talked about that as evidence that Florida is really doing better than Kansas in this key metric and spending a lot less to do that. And so what this article kind of talks about, or what my blog talks about, is a couple things. I'm just going to note them, but I would really draw your attention and say this is something that you can share if people do ask these questions. The first thing that was rather striking to us is that although Florida has historically spent less than Kansas and has done so for many decades, since 2012, since our big tax cuts limiting our budget, Florida has actually increased revenue to education by about twice the percentage of Kansas. Mm-hmm. Do you want to share what Florida's governor has talked about?
Well, when the NAEP results came out, and basically the headline was Florida was really doing well or improved. The Florida governor said,
A
Republican governor, and I think a conservative Republican, mm-hmm, governor, said, well, this shows that the investment made by Florida taxpayers is paying off, and the Florida governor said we've increased funding, I think, $3.4 billion over the past few years, and saying that, you know, the results are basically linked to increases in funding.
So I guess if you're looking at NAEP scores, mm-hmm, Florida does not disprove a connection of funding, because in fact funding has increased and more than Kansas. However, the argument could be made that but they're still spending a lot less than Kansas.
Sure.
And so what we wanted to do, and really what this blog talks about, is other measures, mm-hmm, in addition to NAEP scores, because it's one of the things that KSB every year puts out our Comparing Kansas report card, and we've always said no one indicator – should be the sole determinant of what you look at. NAEP scores are a sample of students. They don't test all kids in any state. They only are given every other year. They're only given in at two grade levels and in two subjects. So while we do not argue that NAEP is an invalid measure, we would say it is a limited measure, and you need to look at other indicators. And so in this article, what we also talk about is looking at, for example, graduation rates, where Kansas not only has a higher graduation rate, and again, there's a little graphic that you can look at that Rob has put up. If you kind of go down the line, although Florida does better than Kansas on some NAEP scores, we test about the same percentage of students as Florida on the ACT, so we're comparable in the number of tested, but have significantly higher percentage of kids in Kansas that are meeting all four benchmarks. We have a higher graduation rate, and again, not only for all kids, because Florida's demographics are different, but we also, for every subgroup, have a significantly higher graduation rate. And I think it's interesting that one of the things that some have cited as a positive for Florida is that they have a no social promotion policy, but one of the things when Kansas considered that, some research suggests that those may have a negative impact on grad. They may increase dropouts. There's evidence shows that, which could explain why, even for subgroups, Florida's graduation rate isn't as good, although they have had some improvement there as well. And then finally, for 18-year-old to 18 to 24-year-old achievement, once again, Kansas does significantly better than the state of Florida. Well, Ted Carter would say, what would caution me about significantly, we are not arguing statistically significant. We're simply laying out, you can look at that. Again, as our school funding data on this little tab would show, while Kansas does spend more than Florida, in recent years, Florida's increased funding faster. And then finally, and I think this is pretty significant to understand, is that one reason that Florida spends less on education is because they are a lower tax state. They are a no-income tax state. Often this is linked as something that is good for your overall economy. And yet one of the things as we've looked at is to show that Kansas has higher per capita income, Kansas has a lower unemployment rate, Kansas has a lower overall poverty rate, and a much lower childhood poverty rate. So I guess the point we would say, if you look at the total package, would you rather be Kansas? Would you rather be Florida? Even with lower taxes, lower spending on education, and better subgroup NAEP scores, Kansas continues to do well. Don't want to minimize the fact Florida has had some improvements, but again, Florida's own governor would say they've been making more investments and believe that there could be a connection. So this is something we wanted to share for our viewers, but also make clear, we hope that if you get these questions, because this discussion is one we've been getting questions about, we've been hearing more about, this is something you may want to use to say, if we're going to look at NAEP scores, let's look at the larger package of educational outcomes. If you're going to look at dollars per pupil, let's also look at trends in funding.
Yeah, I believe it's just a common sense approach. I mean, you know, you can cherry pick data and make Kansas look good or make Kansas look bad, but you know, if you look at a wide variance of data, then you get a better idea. I always think of it in baseball terms. I mean, if you looked at Mickey Mantle's strikeouts, he was a terrible baseball player, but the fact is, he was one of the greatest players of his time. So, I mean, you just can't. I think the best way to do it is just to look at a broad range of data to get a better idea of how a state is actually doing.
And that's certainly something that we've tried to do. We will be updating our Comparing Kansas report. The big issue that we usually have to wait a little bit on is we also try to put in their funding data. There's always a lag, and it is typically in June when a new annual update comes out that will give us information 2016. So unfortunately, the latest data we'll have that is comparable to other states will be a couple of years old, will actually just be the first year of the block grant. Mm-hmm. But that is the only way we have consistent national data from all states. And when that's out, we will take the most recent funding data, the most recent salary data, the most recent achievement data across all these indicators, and have a new update that we will release with great fanfare sometime this summer. Okay, Scott, Rob, Dr. Heim, anything else we want to share?
First of all, tour dates.
Oh, fantastic. And so, yes, very good. So I think what Rob is going to try to show you, we will be beginning our famous annual advocacy tour. And just joining us right on time, hoping we were done, is Leah Fleiter. Welcome. I'm going to ask Leah if she wants to add anything. But what we will note is that...
Step in. I want to see what her green jacket is.
Well, that, you will see Leah's disembodied head, I imagine. We may not want her to do that. So, but this is big news. After you finish a lovely Memorial Day weekend, those of you in Western Kansas will have a chance to be part of the first round of our annual advocacy tour. So Tuesday, May 29th, we will be in Oakley. And then also that day, we will be at Southwest Plains Service Center in Sublette. Keep it coming. And then the next day, we will be starting our day at 8 a.m. in Medicine Lodge at the school board office. And then we will be having, we will be participating in and having a tour stop in conjunction with the USA Conference in Wichita at 1 p.m. on the 30th. And then I believe the USA conference continues Thursday and Friday. And we will be continuing our tour around the state throughout really the first 3 weeks in June. So those of you in Western Kansas will have the first chance to participate. Obviously, school leaders are invited. But the key part of this year's tour is we will be inviting all candidates who have filed for the legislature, the State Board of Education, statewide office, I suppose, and federal offices, members of Congress will all be invited. So this is an opportunity for you to come either meet or bring candidates to learn more about education issues shortly after the filing deadline in anticipation of the August primary and November general election. So Rob is really coordinating our effort to get those dates put together. We'll be sending that information as it becomes more available. So if there's nothing else, I think we will wrap up. Our staff will be, again, celebrating
Siete de Mayo,
our heritage of our neighbors to the south, and the birth of Dr. Heim, and whatever else we get. The end of the session, there's a lot of things to celebrate, but we will be coming to you, if not before, look for our analysis of the oral arguments in a couple of weeks, and then we will hope to see as many of you as possible in June and late May and June in our advocacy tours around the state. Thank you very much.